will be 19-8036, United States versus Coombs.
May it please the court, counsel. Megan Hayes appearing on behalf of Jackson Coombs. The Supreme Court's decision in Gall and this court's Archuleta decision require reversal when a sentence is premised on either legal or factual errors. In this case, the district court made both legal and factual errors when it applied a two-level enhancement for more than minimal planning to Mr. Coombs's aggravated assault conviction. This is the case where Mr. Coombs assaulted a woman in a public restroom in Yellowstone Park. The legal error that we are contending the district court made was in incorrect interpretation and application of the more than minimal planning enhancement, which, according to the guidelines, requires a couple of things: more than is typical to commit the offense in its simple form. It exists if there were significant affirmative steps taken to conceal the offense. According to this court's decision in Archuleta, it requires complex criminal activity. This case was not complicated. It was easily detected, and therefore we're contending that there was no more than minimal planning involved.
The guidelines speak in terms of, and you can correct me, I won't take the time to really pull it up here, but it talks about more complex than in its simplest form, right? That's the predicate for the enhancement.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, most of the cases, at least, if not all of the cases that you cite, occur in the context of white-collar crime. And in those cases, which is where those cases, that enhancement is generally used, one can accept that as being a given. But, I mean, and in those cases, you're going to have to be more complex because in its simplest form, this fraud offense is going to be somewhat complex. So why does that really help you? Because in its simplest form, I can come up and knock somebody in their head. That's its simplest form. I assaulted that person. And so when I choose to put tissue paper over my face to do it, I'm doing something more than in its simplest form to effectuate that crime. Am I not?
Yes, you are, but the distinction is, and I agree that the white-collar crime cases do necessarily involve more complicated activity. Archuleta was one where they said it wasn't. It was easily detected. This was a drug addict. But I did find, in preparing for this oral argument, I actually did find a Tenth Circuit case where an aggravated assault, where the more than minimal planning enhancement was applied to an aggravated assault. It's unpublished, 728 Federal Appendix 810. That's a Tenth Circuit case from 2018. In that case, this was an assault in Indian country. I hate to use that term, but that's how
that's
it's used.
What's the term in the statute.
Yeah.
For the record, let's get a 28J on this after this proceeding, because this is not in your brief, right? This case?
That's correct.
Right.
I just found it last
night. All right.
Yes. And I'm sorry, it's unpublished, and I hadn't seen
okay.
it before.
That's okay. Go ahead.
It's a 2018 case. This is a defendant who planned his attack in advance. He got his girlfriend to drive him to a location. Then he told her, let me take the wheel for a while. He pulled out a knife. He drove her to a secluded area. He told her to take off all her clothes. Then he put her in the trunk. Then he drove to a... I mean, it was quite a bit of advanced preparation to then ultimately drive her to a wooded, secluded area and assault her.
And you infer from that what?
More than minimal planning.
Well, that's a necessary and sufficient problem. Sure, that was sufficient for more than minimal planning. It doesn't say that was necessary for more than minimal planning, right?
No,
you didn't say
but
that.
It, Though it didn't say that. But it did. It is an example, Your Honor, of a case where the crime was premeditated. The crime was pre-planned well in advance to take this woman to a secluded area and assault her. I also found, again, not in my brief, I'm sorry, in my preparation for oral argument, an 11th Circuit case, not controlling authority, but again, just an example. It's U.S. versus Tapia, 59 F3rd 1137. It's a 1995 case from the 11th Circuit where they reversed the conviction where a more than minimal planning enhancement had been applied to an aggravated assault conviction. In that situation, these are inmates in a county jail. A prisoner is brought into their cell area that they've all known for a long time. They chat it up. One of the ultimate defendants goes and makes some phone calls and learns that the new inmate is about to testify. Perhaps you know this from your memos.
No, I just know the scenario.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this was obstruction of justice and I think retaliation were the charges. But anyway, one of the defendants went and made a phone call and learned that this new guy is going to be testifying in a federal drug case against one of their friends. And so then they call this guy over and beat him up, and they're charged with obstruction of justice and retaliation. And the district court applied the more than minimal planning enhancement, and the 11th Circuit vacated, remanded, and said, no, there was no elaborate scheme here. This was not significant planning, no elaborate scheme, no sophisticated plan. Yes, he made the phone call and then collected his friends, but this is not more than minimal planning. It was, in my interpretation, an example of minimal planning, which is what we're contending here, that Mr. Coombs engaged in minimal planning.
Well, maybe, counsel, you could tell me, just connect the facts. Why is this insufficient in this case? I mean, maybe instead of comparing it to other cases,
sure,
just help me understand why you think the facts in this case
insufficient. Because factually, what we know actually from the record is that, and from the PSR, it's paragraph, the revised PSR, paragraph 26, the defendant was in a women's restroom and he covered the lower part of his face with toilet paper in an effort to conceal his identity. So why isn't it more than minimal planning? It's minimal planning. So he was in a bathroom stall and someone comes in and shuts the door. And so perhaps in the minute prior to the assault, he figures, wrap my face in toilet paper and go bang my way in and assault this woman. So it's not, there's no evidence that he entered that bathroom with a plan to assault somebody. There's nothing in the record. So the reason why I'm contending it's not more than minimal planning is that it's minimal planning. It was like at most a minute before the assault took place that he thought, I guess, to devise this sort of ill-conceived attempt to conceal his identity. He didn't conceal his identity. He didn't have a ski mask, which had he had a ski mask or had he had some other way to conceal his identity, I could see how that could constitute more than minimal planning.
Prisons are filled with stupid criminals. I mean, that just as he fails at doing what he was trying to do doesn't mean he didn't do it.
Well,
right?
No, I don't.
Why? Okay, so if he had kept the toilet paper on tight, we had that's a distinction with the difference.
I think in this situation, in these facts, yes, that's an important distinction. It wasn't that he concealed his identity. He didn't conceal his
identity. Well, you said he was doped up. He put on toilet paper. Because he was trying to do that, right?
Perhaps. But he didn't. And so is the fact that he didn't succeed relevant? The reason why that fact is relevant or important is because he didn't take significant affirmative steps to conceal his identity. He sort of hurriedly and ineptly attempted to, but didn't, because he took no affirmative
And that's an inference that we're making. We're under a clear error standard, right?
For the facts, correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, for the fact, the finding as to the adjustment is clear error.
The factual findings for the adjustment, yes, but the application and interpretation.
What interpretation are we talking about?
Whether he engaged in significant affirmative steps to conceal his identity.
Okay. Well, the court. Well, part of this would be to suggest the finding that he did this hurriedly. Well, let's assume that's an inference. That's a factual inference. Maybe he didn't do it hurriedly. He just screwed it up. And if he screwed it up, then we're in the same place, right? There's no. That would be viewed for clear error. We'd interpret the hurriedly is not an inference the court has made, right?
That's correct.
That's right. Okay. Now, on the point about it, the fact, I take it that part of this is being framed as a spontaneous act. Well, how do we know it's spontaneous? He's in the bathroom, and he could have been waiting and lying in wait. There's nothing in the record to suggest that that's not what he was doing, is there?
No, but there's nothing to suggest. There's no one who said, yeah, I saw him go in there 15 minutes earlier. There's nothing to support. And in fact, the PSR didn't even say that. It just said he was in the women's bathroom. It didn't say he was in there waiting. That's come later with, you know, subsequent iterations of what happened by the government. But the PSR quite simply said he's in the women's bathroom.
Okay. Well, if the clear error, clearly erroneous standard is the deferential one, the government has the burden to prove this, granted. But if he is in that restroom, the court finds he's in the restroom, court finds he wraps us around. If there is ambiguity as to whether he had been there in there a long time or not in there a long time, and the court finds that it's sufficient facts to find that he was in there long enough to plan, then under the standard, what does one do with that? I mean, under the if I'm not making myself clear, under the clearly erroneous standard, what does one do with that? I mean, if the court finds that he's in there long enough, and there's nothing in the record that would say he actually did. There wasn't. I'm not saying it was the defendant's burden. I'm just saying there was no record evidence to suggest anybody went in there that he went in there 2 seconds before it happened.
You're correct, Your Honor. but the point is, under the deferential, clear error standard, it is certainly minimal planning. The question here is it more than minimal planning? And I would just say under this Tapia case, and certainly under the other cases that are cited in my brief where there were aggravated assault cases on the Wind River Reservation, it was certainly more planning than what happened here. Yes, was there a time period when he was in that bathroom? He was obviously in the bathroom before this woman arrived. How long? We don't know. Was he waiting? We don't know. Was he using the toilet? We don't know. Is it a reasonable inference that he waited or that perhaps a minute expired before he went in and assaulted her? Yeah, that's a reasonable inference. But does that make it more than minimal planning or just minimal planning?
Well, I look forward to reading Tapia and understanding that. But let me ask you this, if I may. What difference does it make whether it was in this situation, whether it was a women's restroom or a men's restroom? There was some discussion. I think that was one of your factual errors, that the court made some statement to the effect that the restrooms were different when, in fact, they weren't different. What difference does it make? Because as far as the record shows, there's no basis really to think there was a – and I'm asking – was that there was a sexual dimension to this. I mean, he beat her up, but I mean, there's no evidence that he tried to do anything sexual to her, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
I've got 9 seconds. Do you want me to go ahead?
Well, no, you could do either way. I'll give you a little more time if you want it, but so let's say we'll spot you 30 seconds. So
okay.
Have a seat.
The significant...
Or not.
Oh,
or
sorry.
Not. I was saying you could have rebuttal of 30 seconds if you want it. If you want to go on, use your 30 now.
Oh, I just was going to answer your question about what was the relevance of the... that he was in the women's bathroom.
Oh, right, do it, please.
Yeah, the relevance is that if you look at... and it's cited in my brief or detailed in the brief where the district court says, and he was in the women's bathroom where he should have noticed the accommodations. So the inference is he went in there and knew it was the women's bathroom. There's really, again, no evidence in the red. The bathrooms are the same. So he wouldn't have gone in and said, no urinals in here. I must be in the women's bathroom. No, the reason it's important is because the implication from the district court is he went into the bathroom to assault a woman and had a plan to do it. And that's why it's significant. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Christine Martins and I represent the United States. We're asking this court to affirm the district court, finding both that the sentence was procedurally and substantively reasonable. This court's review is for reasonableness, using its familiar abuse of discretion standard, and has been already discussed. The district court's factual findings will be reviewed for clear error, and any legal decisions get de novo review when using that discretion. So I'm going to start off by talking about these extra cases, the 10th Circuit case and the 11th Circuit case. I think it's probably a little dangerous to address cases that are outside of the briefing, but just based off of what we've discussed here, I think that 10th Circuit case hits the nail on the head in terms of sufficient and necessary. That problem, certainly such a calculated attack would give you sufficient basis to find more than minimal planning, but that doesn't answer the question for us of what is necessary to find more than minimal planning. So I think we can set that aside. And then the 10th Circuit case, where we're describing this as an obstruction case, I would point the court to application note 2 for the more than minimal planning enhancement, which is found at 2A2.2B1. So application note 2 tells us that the more than minimal planning enhancement also exists if significant affirmative steps were taken to conceal the offense other than conduct to which 3C1.1 applies, in parentheses, obstructing or impeding the administration of justice.
You're responding to the Tapia case.
Yes, sir.
Well, I at least I understand. I think we're flying blind unless you've already read Tapia.
I have not.
Well, then we're both flying blind, and I don't know whether this is necessarily a good exercise to engage in, but to the extent that we're going to do it, my impression from what defense counsel said was it wasn't based upon that overlap provision. It was based upon actually finding that it was not minimal.
Right.
It was not more than minimal planning.
But I think that the point here is that our application note expressly excludes circumstances that sound very similar to that, so I don't think that's helpful here, and I would agree with Your Honor. But that application note, I think, is very helpful in figuring out exactly what it was the district court was doing when it was viewing the facts presented to it. So that application note tells us that we need more than what is necessary for the commission of the offense in its simplest form, and it goes on to give examples of taking actions to affirmatively conceal the offense, including things like donning a ski mask or luring a victim, but telling us also that simply waiting until no one is around to commit an offense is not enough on its own. So we don't have to exclude those facts, but we're not going to find it just basically or simply because a defendant has waited to commit an offense. So looking at the facts here, the district court specifically listed, and you'll find this in the appendix at page 96 and 97, listed the facts that it relied on. It relied on the fact that he was in the stall, in the women's restroom, that he waited until the victim, MC, was in the stall, had closed the door, that he wrapped his head with toilet paper and he barged through the door. And I think that these facts support the finding of the district court.
Well, is it material that he whether he was in a men's restroom or a women's restroom? Because as it turns out, the court's inference that he knew he was in a women's restroom is not founded based upon the configuration of the restroom. So is it material at all?
I don't think it's material in this case, but I wouldn't concede that the district court was wrong either. At page 314 in the record, you'll find a diagram submitted with Coombs's sentencing memorandum that actually showed that the layout of these two bathrooms was, in fact, different.
Different in what sense? I think I had in mind what the court was getting at, and so what difference is there then?
There's a closet in the men's bathroom that houses a water heater. Granted, there were no urinals in the men's bathroom, which we could infer that's what the district court meant by accommodations.
Seemed pretty natural inference, yeah.
But I don't think that the record is crystal clear that the district court actually got it wrong. And so when we're talking about the factual findings, that's where we come back to the standard of review. We're looking for clear error in those factual findings. And there is something in the record that supports the idea that these restrooms were different. And if the district court simply chose the wrong word to describe it, or a word that would leave this court with some doubt about exactly what it was getting at, I don't think that's quite enough to support clear error.
You're saying there was a room and that there's record evidence about this different configuration that you're talking about?
Yes, yes.
All right. Well, what from that would have led the court to infer that he knew it was a women's restroom as opposed to a men's? I mean, the fact that they have different configuration would not speak to that gender issue.
I don't think it would, but certainly the court is allowed to take notice of the fact that these bathrooms are generally clearly labeled. And defendant, as reflected, in the PSR, even had some post-secondary education. So he certainly could read, write, understand the English language, all of those sorts of things, to be able to realize that he was in the wrong bathroom.
Well, what I'm getting at is, why is it, does it really matter? I mean, because the assault has not been, as far as I could tell from the record, nobody's labeling it a sexual assault. So, I mean, does it really matter whether he knew he was in a women's restroom? He could have just wanted to assault somebody.
That's absolutely true, Your Honor. I don't think that it makes or breaks this case, whether he knew he was in the wrong bathroom or not. So, when we look at his actions, here we have Coombs, who is in a bathroom stall, closed into a bathroom stall. He is armed. He has bear spray. He has a 2-inch pocket knife, and he has those large rings on his fingers. Someone else, even if he doesn't know it's a woman coming into that bathroom, someone else comes into a bathroom and goes into their own stall and closes the door. His response to that is to wrap his face in toilet paper in a makeshift disguise, leave his bathroom stall, beat down the door of the other bathroom stall to gain access to this person, enter that stall, spray that person with bear spray, close the stall door behind him, beat that person, and prevent her from escaping him as he beats her, even going so far as to hold her still to be beaten. Now, when we look at that chain of events, the question really is the necessary versus sufficient facts to find that more than minimal planning aspect. And I think that that's where we can come back to that application note number 2 to this guideline. Here, when we wait to commit this offense until no one else is around, that's not enough by itself, but we can certainly think about it and add it into the calculus. And then the guideline gives us a specific example about donning a ski mask. Here, defendant has wrapped his face in toilet paper specifically to conceal his identity. And there was no other logical inference that the district court had to draw from that action. This court pretty recently in Dickerson said that where the facts in a case support two views of the evidence, that a district court is not going to clearly error by drawing one of those permissible inferences. So certainly the district court was not required to draw any other inference, and it was a logical inference that that step was affirmatively taken to conceal his identity. Furthermore, district courts are not required to put every single reason that they find for a sentence on the record. And so I would submit to the court
that... Are you positing there are other reasons?
Oh, clearly available from the facts, Your Honor, that he closed that bathroom door behind him. I think that that could have played into the calculus here about whether he was affirmatively attempting to conceal this assault and the fact that it was occurring. And, you know, as the comment explains, we can also look at the fact that he waited until no one was around. Well, that's not sufficient on its own.
Well,
we don't have to subtract it.
We don't even know that, do we? I mean, that there's a question mark as to whether he waited. I mean, as I said, that may go in the favor of this judgment in light of clearly erroneous standard. But there's no evidence in the record as to how long he was in there, is there?
There's no evidence in the record as to the amount of time he was in there. But what it is in the record is that there was actually no one else in that bathroom.
All right. Well, that's different than him waiting until there was no one around. That implies somebody comes in, he waits, they go out, then he does the assault. We don't have that, right?
We don't have that.
Okay.
But based on what we do have, I think that it's at least fair to allow the district court to think about whether or not there was anybody else around when that assault actually occurred. So all of those facts support the district court's finding that more than minimal planning was here in this offense. And that's really the heart of the procedural question before this court under Gaul, is whether or not the district court correctly calculated the guideline range based on that more than minimal planning enhancement. So finding that there is sufficient evidence in the record to support the more than minimal planning enhancement, then we would move on to the substantive question. And it's worth noting that if the sentencing range is appropriately calculated, then when we get to step two and look at the substance of the sentence, we have a presumption of reasonableness that applies to that appropriately calculated guideline sentence.
He didn't even get the top of the guideline range, right? That's my memory.
No, he got a middle guideline range, Your Honor. The guideline based on his criminal history category and the enhancements that applied was a 70 to 87-month guideline range. Below, the government requested the 87-month sentence, and he only got 78. And I think that it's also worth noting here that in both the defense's sentencing memorandum and before the district court, the defense characterized what they were asking for as an extreme variance. They went so far as to ask for a probationary sentence based on these facts. And that's actually completely contrary to the guidelines, not only an enormous downward departure, but his sentence is in zone D of that chart in the back of the book, where we presume we're not going to allow a probationary sentence. So that question on appeal, the request on appeal, has changed from a probationary sentence to a sentence of 51 months. But again, that gets us down outside of the guideline range. And we would not only have to decrease for those two levels for the minimal planning enhancement, but we'd also have to get a downward departure on his criminal history category in order to get to a sentence of 51 months.
Well, we're talking about a variance. We wouldn't have to do any of those things.
But if we were going to try and put it in the range.
3553, and they could reach that result, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. What you were talking about was working the guidelines as if it were a departure, but that's not what we're dealing with.
Well, and I think the only reason that I point those things out to the court is there's discussion in the other side's brief about his criminal history being overstated. And when we look at that question under the substantive question, where we would be looking at a variance rather than a departure, we aren't challenged here on appeal finding any actual mistake as to that calculation, but essentially that we're asking for, or the defendant is asking for, sort of a discount on his criminal history in order to make that more reasonable on his variance and substantive argument. But again, I would say that the district court was well-founded in looking at this particular offender's history, finding that his history included multiple violent assaults that included weapons, and imposing the sentence that it did, both for specific and general deterrence and protection of the public. If there are no further questions, Your Honors, the government respectfully requests that Mr. Coombs' sentence be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. Cases are submitted, and we are in recess. Thank you.